Imagine if a professional filmmaker helped you make your first film. Imagine if when you're making your first film in high school or wherever you made your first film, you had a professional filmmaker meet with you once a week to help you make that film. Imagine what that would have done to your learning as an artist, your growth as an artist, and the film itself. That's what happens at RealWorks. So you can be that person who changes someone's life, not just maybe the future filmmaker they may or may not be, but in mentoring a young person, you know, our mentors come back again and again because it's an incredible experience to give back in a very direct way to a young artist who is telling his or her story. And that's what happens here every day.
This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio, the independent film talk show. It's a podcast about independent cinema. A kind of an interesting show today. I have two different segments. One is with John Williams, who is, along with his wife, Stephanie. He is a co-founder and executive director of RealWorks. They're located in Park Slope, Brooklyn. It's an after-school program where they teach high schoolers how to make documentary films. And they put cameras in the hands of these aspiring filmmakers. It's kind of exciting. They also set up mentorship programs with the kids, and it's unbelievably, you know, effective in terms of just giving these kids focus and determination and a channel for their creative energy. So John will be on this segment. And then I also have an interview with Jamie Wilkinson, who I met not too long ago. He is co-founder of organization called VHX. They're the ones that are, well, one of the ones anyway, that are putting the a player on your homepage so you can play your movie or your concert or whatever your video is. You can play it right off your homepage. It's sort of part of the evolution of how people are, you know, continuing, how people are watching content. You know, nowadays you buy a Mac, and I don't even think there's a DVD player anymore. Am I, you know, correct? A recorder, burner, player? I think they're gone. The new models don't even have them, so you have to buy an external one if you need it. Everything is off the internet now, and I'm just kind of wondering, though, I mean, are we really there yet? And what if you don't have access to Wi-Fi? It's not like it's everywhere. So I'm just wondering how people cope when they don't have it and they want to stream something. But I guess it's the case of the, you know, the hardware trying to lead this the technology in the right direction. Anyway, all I can tell you is that it's not unusual for me to hop on the subway or on a train or in a car and watch a DVD. Recently, we as we're heading toward Cannes and coming out of Tribeca, I just wanted to mention a few films that I did have the opportunity to see while I was dashing around Tribeca. One is coming out very shortly. It's called Palo Alto. It's directed by Gia Coppola. It's a little darker than I thought. It's sort of about high schoolers, but it is enters some dark territory. And I will say that, you know, I almost completely forgot that this was Emma Roberts. I mean, no disrespect, she's done a lot of good work for such a young actress, but this was something that she was much more of a mature role for her. I also saw Lucky Them, directed by Megan Griffiths, who made a film a couple years ago called The Off Hours, and then she had a film called Eden, which was very dark. And she's back, though, now with a feel-good comedy called Lucky Them. And it's delightful, and I got to speak to Megan and her producer, Emily Wachtel. That was a pleasure. That show will be coming up pretty soon. We'll might as well position it, though, close to its theatrical. Lucky Them stars Toni Collette, Thomas Hayden Church, Oliver Platt, and others, and happens to be executive produced by Joanne Woodward. That's right, the widow of Paul Newman and the great actress in her own right, Joanne Woodward. I got to see Five Star. If you are a regular listener to this podcast, you will know it was directed by, or maybe you don't, and you're still a regular listener, but Five Star was directed by Keith Miller, who's been on this podcast a couple of times. It's about a Brooklyn gang leader and his young protege, who is the son of a former associate of this gang leader named Primo. Primo, anyway, is from the gangs. I don't think he's in a gang anymore. I don't know the whole backstory. Well, we'll find out soon, because I'll have on Keith, Primo, and the other star of the film, John Diaz. You know what else got some great reviews and great reception was Ohner's film, Summer of Blood. That did quite well at the festival. We did a couple of Q&As that were a lot of fun, and a lot of folks stuck around for the Q&As. And I did them with producer Max Heller, which was a lot of fun. And Ohner's film just got picked up by MPI for distribution. That means that it will be playing in a theater and on all sorts of other on-demand digital platforms in the coming months. How exciting for Ohner. Congratulations to Ohner Tukel, the director of Summer of Blood, which I saw at also at the Tribeca Film Festival. What else did I see there that was outstanding? I saw Kelly Reichardt's film, Night Moves. That was great. That stars Jesse Eisenberg, and it's a kind of controversial thing. I was supposed to introduce it at one of the screenings, and I did go, and I met with Kelly, which was nice because I got to plant some seeds. And then she teaches up at a college upstate New York. I don't know if I should be so specific as to mention where, but it just so happens coincidentally that my ex-wife, who is an actress, will be up at this campus this summer, for 2 months of the summer, working at this at school. And so I'm going to be up there, and I figured, you know what? Let's track down Kelly and see if she'll do the podcast. We met. Turned out well. I didn't end up introducing the film, but we still had a great time. And the film is really sensational. That's the great news about it. I saw a great film called Love is Strange by Ira Sachs. You may recall Ira. He was on a year or more ago with his film Keep the Lights On. Well, he's back with his film Love is Strange. And I did play an extra in the movie, and I actually didn't know until I went to the Tribeca Film Festival and saw a screening of the film whether or not I actually ended up in the final edit. Well, I kind of did. Not exactly how I thought I would, but I did. There was a scene in a bar with John Lithgow and Alfred Molina where they're sitting at the bar, and I'm like in that shot. I thought I was at the shot, but I wasn't. You could barely see me. I'm kind of obscured. You can see my ear, the side of my face a little bit, but I never quite fully, you know, enter the shot. So that's unfortunate. But a little next scene later, after, which is towards the end of the film, I walk down the block, walk right past camera, but pretty far back. But I'm there. I'm in the film. I'm in Love is Strange. I'm in Ira Sachs. I'm in an Ira Sachs film, which feels really good. Even despite that, I would still recommend going and seeing Love is Strange. It's going to have its theatrical soon. I'll of course come back and talk more specifics about when all these films are playing, because they're all so good. Another wonderful film was Manos Suchius. That was terrific. I saw Mala Mala, which is produced by the folks at Killer Films. That's Christine Vachon's outfit. I saw Loitering with Intent, which was a lot of fun. I got to meet the whole crew of that film, including Sam Rockwell. So I'm hoping I just planted seeds. I didn't like attack him. I didn't like go up, but we hit it off. We met. We had a nice Q&A together, and I think when it comes time, we might get like a Sam Rockwell on air. So just keep, if you're listening though, you have an actual connection to any of these people, by all means, email me at adam@filmwax.com and help me expedite matters. I mean, I can reach all these people eventually, but if you can help me move that up a little bit. Another film, Startup, is a really, really tough British film about an incarcerated young guy who's ends up being in the same jail as his father. Pretty amazing, though, but really, really gritty film. That, again, that's called Starred Up, Starred. And I saw the one I love, which is an offbeat romance film directed by Charlie McDowell. And then also saw a film called The One I Love. That one has Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss, who you know, of course, from Mad Men. They co-starred in this, and it's a very offbeat film. I can't really, it's a comedy, but it has a weird genre hybrid nature to it, which I don't want to give away at the moment. All I could tell you is is it was great, and I ended up doing a Q&A. Mark Duplass, not there. I was disappointed, but got to meet Elizabeth Moss. Couldn't be lovelier. And then a bunch of other films, you know. But I saw more films at this Tribeca Film Festival than I've seen at any other. And part of the reason is because I was just very organized this year, and I kind of coordinated things. I was involved in a lot of Q&As, so I wanted to see a lot of the stuff ahead of time. Also, I just got into the industry and press screenings in a better rhythm and got to bite off a lot more this year. So I saw plenty of really good film, and it was very good. I caught very few duds, almost none, one or two that could have been stronger. But, you know, you go to a major festival like this, they're not going to probably program duds in there. They do a lot to avoid doing that. That's about all I want to talk about. I'd rather right now go into the first conversation for this particular podcast, episode 209. This one is with, again, going into my conversation with John Williams of RealWorks. And then I'll come back with a quick introduction to my conversation with Jamie at VHX. Here it is, John Williams, RealWorks. John Williams, welcome to FilmWax Radio.
Thank you, Adam. Nice to be here.
Yeah, John, you're the founder and executive director of RealWorks here in Brooklyn.
That's right.
And you come from a broadcasting background, producing, and take it
that
right?
Yeah, I'm co-founder with my wife, Stephanie, and we were both filmmakers and television producers when we met and married, and we're working full-time. She was doing our documentaries for CBS News Productions and Lifetime and Women's Entertainment, and I was freelancing as a segment producer for TV and for Rainbow Communications and PBS. I was sort of a journeyman producer at that point.
Not just journalistic or documentary stuff, though. More than that.
Yeah, I was just making my way in TV as a producer, and Stephanie was much more of an accomplished documentary filmmaker. I was a graduate of NYU Film School, so I had done my work there. I produced TV commercials and independent films. I had sort of had a long climb from film school. But when we started RealWorks, we were just starting to teach filmmaking at the YMCA. We were both working TV producers at the time.
When you were coming out of school, was this undergraduate or graduate at NYU?
Graduate.
When you came out of that program, did you already have it in mind that you wanted to be behind the camera? Well, you were always behind the camera, but did you want to be doing maybe more on the producer side of things, producing, rather than just being on the crew or, you know, making films?
Well, you know, in film school, I was a director. I was in film school. I mean, NYU teaches you the auteur theory, which you find when you graduate.
Yeah.
They're lining up to hire you as a writer, director, auteur, filmmaker. So
that's ironic.
Yeah, it's funny that in this major media town, at least when I graduated from NYU in 1992, they were very much selling the Hollywood myth of, you know, right. You know, you'll get a 5-picture deal if you do a great thesis film. So, but I was very much, I very much drunk that Kool-Aid, and I was believing that. But I was the guy in film school who could produce and production manage. So when I got out of film school and started working and PAing and location scouting and doing all the things you do, you know, as starting to work on film crews, I focused on production. I knew that was my strength, and so I ended up in the office. I ended up as a coordinator and a producer in TV commercials, and I worked at the Shooting Gallery.
Oh, you did, huh?
Yeah, with Larry Maestrich and Bob, and all those guys.
Bob Goss.
So that's what I was doing.
Okay.
And then I made... I tell the story to my students, which is one of my epiphany moments. So it was around close to 2000, and I was production managing for this great bunch of commercials, best TV job I ever had, best TV commercial job I ever did. It was for VH1, and I was working with a great producer I really enjoyed working with, and I was production managing. And it was a series of ads for VH1 with the Rolling Stones and with I think we were in Chicago. We were going to interview John Mellencamp, which tells you how long ago it was, but still. And the director was this really talented director who lives in Park Slope. His name is John Kane from Optic Nerve. And we were driving in Chicago to the location in wherever we were shooting with John Mellencamp. And the PA who we hired to drive the van was sort of green. And he wasn't in New York. A PA kind of knows not to talk to the director so much, you know. But the PA didn't have that line in his head. He was just talking to John, and John's a nice guy. So he said, "How do you become a director?" And John said, "Well, you make stuff and you show it to people." Mm-hmm. And you keep making stuff and you keep showing it to people. And he said, "You're either the guy who makes the stuff, mm-hmm. or you're the guy who helps people make stuff." And if you make that choice, if you're the guy that helps people make stuff, that's how people will think of you, and that's what you'll be. But if you're a guy who makes stuff, that's what you'll be.
Right.
And I'm sitting in the back seat. I have a giant notebook filled with location stuff. I have a
you're the guy helping people make stuff.
I have
stuff.
A cell phone yeah. the size of a brick, yeah. you know, right. and uh-huh. and I had, you know, I was the guy who helped people make stuff. So I was so far away from my creative dream. I left TV commercials right after that, and I started producing for Metro Channels in New York, which was Rainbow Communications' attempt to recreate local programming. And I ended up being hired.
Was it Channel 5 or something?
Yeah, it was.
Was that Metro Media Television?
Not Metro Media. It was okay. It was the Dolans. It was Cablevision's.
Okay.
They had a suite of channels, and they were all about what to do in New York. So my first day of the job, it was go make a piece about fashion. Mm,
right.
I became a fashion producer. And I knew nothing about fashion, but I knew how to tell a story. And I got to tell stories. And that got me kind of back as a storyteller, which, you know, kind of led me back. You know, even though it was so different from my dream of being a Hollywood filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
I was a storyteller again.
Right.
And that kind of started getting me back to my creative self.
Yeah. Are you from, you're from New York, or?
I grew up in Larchmont.
Uh-huh.
And,
in Westchester.
Yeah, and I went to Boston University undergrad,
uh-huh.
and then I came to NYU Film School in 87.
And you've been out here since?
Ever since.
Let's talk about RealWorks, which is where you find yourself now. What year when did you and Stephanie found RealWorks?
Well, we were living in Park Slope, mm-hmm. About a block from the Prospect Park YMCA.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephanie was freelancing then also, and she had done a short piece about this pickup basketball league at the Y. It was just a little piece she did for a local show. And I guess we were the last filmmakers to be in the building because they decided they needed to find filmmakers to teach a class with teenagers. And so they called us.
Yeah.
I mean, we're in Park Slope. It's a lot of filmmakers, but we were like the local filmmakers because we're the last piece of people.
Right.
So they called Stephanie and said, "We're doing a project at the Y. A bunch of retired sailors live here and merchant mariners. And we want to do we're doing a oral history with teenagers taking their lives."
Is this like in the 40s? I mean, this is merchant mariners living in the Y.
Well, their careers were in the 40s and 50s, and they were all retired.
Yeah. They were all like 85-year-old guys with no teeth and who drank rum out of a bag.
It was, yes, you describe it kind of accurately.
Yeah.
It's men who, as we say, didn't navigate their lives very well and ended up in their old age essentially homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived in this program at the Y. Which was a terrific program.
Sounds like
Siemens
it.
House, yeah. And they were fascinating guys because they lived on the sea before container ships. I learned this. And before container ships, you go into port and you'd be there for 2 or 3 weeks, and then you move on. With container ships, you're there for
container
like 2 or 3
hours. Where they stack.
Yeah,
right. Okay, go ahead.
So they were real sailors from the real golden age of sailing from World War II through the change into container ships in the 60s and 70s. So it was fascinating, and the teenagers that the Y had recruited were great, and we taught a class with them. And that project ended up being featured on Channel 13 and got covered in the
Is
Times.
That right? Wow.
Yeah, it was really a terrific project.
Mm-hmm.
But we said to the Y, we said, you know, the teenagers are kind of interesting too. Sailors are great, but we're really interested in these kids. Could we do a project where they told their own stories? So this was in 2001. And then the Y said great, and they bought us a bunch of cameras, and they paid us, and we did a class of kids who told their own stories, mm-hmm. with Steffi and I mentoring them, essentially.
I know that I met your son not long ago.
My son Henry, yeah.
Yeah, but so he's way too young to have been around then.
Right.
Where did the inspiration, though, start to want to work with youngsters?
You know, it was just a gig. Mm-hmm. We were making some extra money teaching after school. We loved it. I mean, first, we loved it automatically. I don't know if Steffi and I knew we had any destiny to do this. Mm-hmm. We were still focused on our careers as TV producers. But I remember we were working with a couple students, and the movies came together in a very exciting way. Mm-hmm. And it was collaborative. We were bringing our skills and ability and of storytelling, and the students were bringing their stories and their ideas, and we were collaborating with them to tell their stories. Mm-hmm. And the work itself, as it came together on the timeline, and I was only learning Final Cut then, I'd been sitting behind editors my entire career. I hadn't been editing since it was a Steenbeck at the Shooting Gallery, right? So I'm kind of learning and getting hands-on as a filmmaker again as well, and shooting again and editing again and working with these kids. And the work was remarkable. I mean, it really was remarkable. And I said to Steffi, we're going to invest in this. There's something going on here where these films are different than anything we'd seen. And it was exciting. Mm-hmm. And in that first class, we had six kids finish that class. Two films ended up being broadcast in HBO Family. One got a student Emmy nomination, and the student got flown to London and AFI and in Hollywood, and it was remarkable. I'd gotten more positive feedback from the work I did with kids than I had ever gotten as a TV producer.
The bar is fairly low. I don't mean that in a bad way, but right. The bar is really low for a young person, right? They may have a lot to prove in the big
low
scheme of things, but the expectations,
yes,
are very low in terms, yeah, of what they're going to do. So when they do create something,
yeah,
not surprisingly, talent, a result of talent,
yeah,
people are always shocked and taken back. But they don't have they don't bring a lot of baggage,
right?
Right, to their production.
Oh,
they're kind
that.
Of open well, minded about.
I would,
they don't
I would
have rules.
To, yeah, I would
entrenched.
Try to teach kids all the rules, right?
Yeah,
you know, and they'd just break
resist
them.
It. Yeah,
and, no, they just break them.
Oh,
and then the work, you know,
it was more actively rebellious than just not.
They were going with their instincts,
yeah,
and
right.
You know, and stuff would come back, and it would cut together. In fact, to be more exciting. Mm-hmm. The way they framed it, or where they switched from black and white to color, or all sorts of, you know, where they held the camera, what they did. And it was, you know, so it was a kind of storytelling, kind of footage that I couldn't produce as a producer. I'd be fired. Mm-hmm. So I hadn't, you know, it was a lot more creative. Mm-hmm. And it made me a better filmmaker immediately, mm-hmm. because we were playing with form again, and I hadn't had an opportunity to do that in my career as a TV producer, because I had to produce broadcast standard stuff. So that to me was really exciting creatively. And then people responded, and then HBO became our first sponsor.
Yeah, noticed.
And then foundations, and then it slowly took over our lives.
It seems as though there was a, the timing seemed just right for one thing, but usually that's the case. But it seemed like there was a demand. You know, there was like an appetite for watching.
Yeah.
You know, the work by inexpensive, you know, young young creative talent. You know.
Well, the timing was, so this is 2000, 2001, 2000. You know, when we started, in 2001. So really, you know, Final Cut was pretty new then. So the ability to, and mini DV was new.
Sure.
And so it really was just the beginning of the time when you could make broadcast quality media on your computer,
right,
with a camera.
I mean,
and
most
so
people were still
it was
still
before
shooting.
Internet. I was still, sure, saying things out on VHS to get screened. But it was just the beginning of that democratization process, which really started with the mini DV revolution.
Sure.
Yeah.
It must be amazing to run an operation like RealWorks over the span of time that, as you described, the last dozen years, where, I mean, that the evolution of technology, as it in particular,
right,
around shooting and editing and distributing,
yeah,
and exhibiting, all are like, I mean, it's just it's an amazing.
Over 10 million people have seen our work.
Yeah,
it's you know, it started. We had a hit record in 2005. A student made a film called A Girl Like Me, which got very famous because she recreated a famous doll test that was which was used during the Brown versus Board of Education case, in which young black children were asked to distinguish and choose between white dolls and the black dolls, which are otherwise identical. And she recreated that test in a daycare center in Harlem, and it was remarkable and depressing with kids choosing.
Well, I know where it's going. Yeah,
but it was remarkable filmmaking. And her name was Keri Davis. Her mentor was Shala Lynch.
Sure.
And right. The filmmaker
Angela Davis.
Right. Yeah. So that was that film became it won the Media That Matters Film Festival, and it was one of the first sort of internet viral movies that we were part of.
Yeah.
And like 7 or 8 million people saw that movie. It was on Oprah. It was on, you know, it went all the way.
Yes, exactly.
And that really, and that course took us by complete surprise because we hadn't been prepared for that. We had, our films been seen by a lot of people and festivals and stuff. But again, that was just the internet and streaming really just starting in a big way. And that's 2005. And, you know, it was still pretty primitive then. And it was crashing servers. It was even our server because we didn't.
You didn't host it.
We did host it, but we didn't host it in the beginning. YouTube wasn't really happening then. So
I forget what year that all kind of came together.
Yeah.
But it was like mid-2000s where.
Yeah, so it was
like
just
beginning of FaceTime,
it was just before
Facebook
that.
And YouTube were kind of all in the same period.
So that course, you know, we reached more people with that student film than we may have even had as producers making TV in New York, you know, I mean,
sure.
So it really proved the power. And this is a kid, as a high school kid in New York, on the little office on the roof of the Y with a mentor and Final Cut and a mini DV camera and a good idea, a great idea actually, and great execution. And the film, you know, became part of the cultural conversation about race in America. And that put us on the map in a very significant way.
So essentially, RealWorks works with high school age children. In an after-school, primarily, right?
Yep.
In after-school workshops.
We
right, when you give them, yeah, you give them the resources and the space and the mentoring to go and make documentary films.
That's right. We serve about 250 kids in our after-school program.
How many?
About 250.
Okay.
And most of them join our program. They're put in a about 40 of those students come into programs where they're matched one-on-one with mentors to create original films, documentary films, and then for our advanced students, fiction films. But the core work is one-on-one mentoring with professional filmmakers, every student telling his or her story in a six-month workshop in which they write and develop and create and shoot in a story. We're about to graduate 11 students from the current cohort, I call our fall lab class. They're going to screen their work at HBO on Friday, April 11th. And if this is 2014, it could be close to our 26th class. We graduated through that program. And
so you do about 2 a year?
Yeah, 2 a year, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we have a summer program. And then we work in schools as well and serve about 250 kids in schools as well.
That's pretty significant. So is there a couple of cases that have come about where they've evolved into this is their careers and they're now, because your first few years now are, you know, obviously
I have graduates
late 20s.
Now who are the late 20s, Well, we recently surveyed our graduates. We found, actually, it was very cool because we learned really nice things, and they said really nice things about the impact of our programs on their lives, which is obviously, you know, we're a filmmaking program, but, you know, we're a youth development program where we exist to help young people, and filmmaking is a great way to help young people because not only do they tell their story, but they engage with technology, and they use critical thinking, and they write, and they think, and then mentoring is obviously the most effective way to influence positively the outcomes of young people's lives and choices, right? So I say the secret sauce of what we do is called art making plus mentoring plus time. They're here with us a long time. Mm-hmm. You put those together, and then there's almost no way you can't have a positive impact on a young person's life. So, but we learned that 43% of our graduates who are working today, those who are working in entertainment and TV.
Media.
So ReWorks has been creating a diverse and talented workforce for New York's $5 billion film and TV industry. We've been doing that for 12 years. We haven't had a breakout, you know, Sundance winner since we graduated, but we have students who work at NBC, who work at Viacom, who work at HBO. We have a student who is working at the Weinstein Company right now as a post-production effects editor.
Well, so that may come back to haunt you yet.
Yes, exactly. So we have students working in the industry now. In fact, we're doing a big push to re-engage a lot of them. Also, well, as mentors.
I was going to say, what better source of tomorrow's mentors?
Yeah. You know? And also try to help young people. I'm very interested in helping young people make that first film, because I'm just interested in that. Could we have kind of a Sundance Lab kind of structure where after college,
next
they come
generation,
back
and
we help them make their movie? I'd like to move into that direction a little bit too, because we have youth and we have equipment, we have a production company, you know, so some very, very talented former students who I'd love to help make their own work.
So if I run the principal of a school or what have you in New York, I guess, which is the only city so far
The only city so far we serve is
which makes sense just in terms of media. I can't imagine there are too many other cities that would where the synergy would work so well, or you know the whole mechanism.
You need the filmmakers.
Yeah.
So maybe New York, maybe
maybe other city.
LA, right? Yeah. Or maybe Chicago or Boston. But how many other places would have the filmmaking?
Austin,
maybe, right? You know, so we're thinking about that. We're thinking of replicating our program someplace else in the future.
Could be
maybe in New York,
smaller
maybe
scale.
Elsewhere.
Yeah. Of course, Trenton is huge. these are public schools or charter schools or all the above, or where, you know, the schools that you work with?
We partner with about 20 Brooklyn high schools at any given time as feeder programs to our schools. But we're a Brooklyn organization, and but students can come here from anywhere, and we work with schools.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
If you're a high schooler anywhere and you're just you would consider
it's tough for Bronx kids.
Sure.
We haven't had too many Bronx kids because of the travel time, but we've had kids from all boroughs to the program.
Very good.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I know there's a high school in the Bronx, or at least I remember there was, where that is like teaching film.
Yeah.
But it's at the actual school itself.
That's the cinema school run by Ghetto Film School.
Okay, great. So you're aware of it. Not surprised.
Our peers.
If you want to learn more about ReWorks and what they're doing, or see samples of the works of these amazingly talented youngsters, you can go to realworks.org and check it out. And then I recommend it. It's a great place if you're a filmmaker, which odds are if you're listening to this, you probably are a filmmaker or know one. And especially in the documentary sphere, tell them about ReWorks, because I know that you're always looking for mentors, right?
Oh, yeah.
That would be helpful to you. And I know a lot of filmmakers do listen to this show.
Yeah, no, if you, you know, oftentimes, if you're a working filmmaker, and it can be hard sometimes to find paid work or work to do work that's really as rewarding. Although a lot of our mentors, I take that back, do incredible work and they have the careers we all dream of. But if you're a filmmaker and you want to imagine if a professional filmmaker helped you make your first film. Imagine if when you're making your first film in high school or wherever you made your first film, you had a professional filmmaker meet with you once a week to help you make that film. Imagine what that would have done to your learning as an artist, your growth as an artist, and the film itself. That's what happens at ReWorks. So you can be that person who changes someone's life, not just maybe the future filmmaker they may or may not be, but in mentoring a young person, you know, our mentors come back again and again because it's an incredible experience to give back in a very direct way to a young artist who is telling his or her story. And that's what happens here every day. So go to ReWorks.org and click on support, and you'll find information about the mentor program and how to apply.
And be prepared to change yourself in the process, it sounds like.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Jeremy Sonnier, director of Blue Ruin, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
I'm very interested in this podcast servicing filmmakers. I want it to be, first and foremost, an entertaining and engaging experience for anybody to listen to, but I also do want to make this a resource for you guys. And so this conversation, I think, is more about the technology of distribution, and I think it's really powerful. I think what's going on right now is pretty dramatic in terms of what's happening, and then there's the whole issue of net neutrality and all that that's happening also concurrently, and who knows where we'll be at with that issue in the coming months and years. But for the moment, VHX is a company that gives the filmmaker the tools to put their movie right on their homepage and to sell it to anybody. And as far as the audience member who's downloading the movie, they get a copy that is DRM free, meaning they can, once they have it, they can play it on any device they want to, any time, and on as many devices as they see fit, etc. So it's a very new way of thinking about content, and liberating the filmmaker and the movie watcher, and giving them the choices, and not necessarily limiting their experience on either end. It's a direct pipeline, basically. So the name of that company is VHX. And here is the co-founder of this company. His name is Jamie Wilkinson. Talking with Jamie Wilkinson.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. The company is called VHX. What does it stand for, by the way?
It doesn't stand for anything in particular. We make it up as we go along. Sometimes it's like very hectic.
No, that can't be true.
No. No, it was really kind of like brainstorming three-letter acronyms with my co-founder, Casey, originally, and sort of something really stuck out to us, just sort of that retro appeal, and it's sort of like a TV network, but...
So that was it?
Yeah, it just sounded cool. Oh, okay. We just thought it was cool. It hit all the right notes for us.
It does. We're in Dumbo in the corporate offices here of VHX.
World headquarters.
World headquarters. Pardon me. That's right. And who is your co-founder? Casey?
This guy named Casey Pugh. He was one of the early developers of Vimeo, actually, and helped create the Vimeo player. And worked at Boxy. And so we have kind of like a lot of software development, internet video, DNA.
Right.
Before this, I worked at a video blog called Rocket Boom and helped create a site called Know Your Meme. And then Casey and I worked together on a project called Star Wars Uncut, which was a sort of a fan recreation of Star Wars. And that was kind of the beginning of our working relationship.
A fan recreation? So what would that entail?
Yeah, it was Casey's idea for it was to take Star Wars A New Hope and let
Episode
fans,
7.
Episode 4.
4.
4.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
My son is
7's coming soon.
Episode 4. Yeah, no, I will. My son will probably disown me.
Oh, you're done. Mistake. You're toast, yeah. And his idea was that, you know, seeing the phenomenon, this is around 2009, and crowdsourcing was sort of like a burgeoning idea, and there was a couple of cool projects floating around. And Casey's idea was to chop the movie up into 15-second pieces, because that's like a more manageable chunk for somebody to recreate, and then invite the whole internet to recreate it, and it was just like a deluge of traffic. Turns out Star Wars fans are insane.
That comes as a shock to me. So wait, you could pick a 15-minute segment of
15-second segment.
15-second segment.
Yeah, so it's almost nothing.
But you could pick any 15-second segment that appealed to you?
Was kind of like a selection process where...
Like when you go try to find your seat on your flight online?
Something like that, right? Yeah, okay. Like some scenes were taken.
Yeah.
And it actually got claimed several times over, and so there were several scenes for each scene. And we kind of picked out our favorites. And there was actually kind of a dynamic mechanism where people could like the clips, like the recreations. And then there was a mode where when you watched it, it was actually playing you whatever the most liked version of the movie was at the time.
Oh, that's an awesome idea.
And we actually ended up winning a primetime Emmy for it in 2010.
I wonder if it got into George Lucas's radar.
You know, I don't know if it got across George's desk necessarily, but Lucasfilm were real big fans, and we've worked with them really closely on the project, and they've kind of, they're a part of it now.
Wow, that makes sense. That's great. Wouldn't it be funny if we just talked about this for the entire time?
Yeah, well, it really is the genesis of the company, because that was sort of our, we're both software developers, and that was our introduction to sort of the bigger world of how all this media gets made, because winning an Emmy, we became members of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, and started attending all these events where we were meeting media executives, and as a lover of film and television content and right. somebody who doesn't have cable, my million-dollar question was always, hey, when are you going to stop, like, time-shifting the releases of all this stuff? Like, all my friends are talking about it on Twitter because they have cable. Like,
right.
you know, why can't I get this, like, you know, the day after or even the right. night of?
But it's a conversation, and maybe it'll happen now, but it's there's an inevitability to that particular idea. I mean, it seems almost impossible to imagine that in X number of years from now, the idea of a schedule... It's in fact, it's already happened. It just mm-hmm. means the people that are holding on to that idea are kind of a little late to the game. In other words, you know, it's
yeah,
well,
I guess. They're all, you know, hedging right. their current business model too. Like they are make, you know, people are dipping their toes into it, like HBO Go and Showtime
right.
Anywhere. So many of the networks have sort of, you know, stream anytime, anywhere sort of services, but mm-hmm. it's still so often tied to authenticating with your cable account, which is just this not great user experience. You know, like when I was trying to watch the Olympics, I had to remember which cable provider I have and then dig up my credentials for it and then log in with it. And it's mm-hmm. it's kind of just like a little bit of a clunky experience. And if there's anything that we've learned developing software for the last 10, 15 years, it's that it has to be easy. And really, like, the missed opportunity is just making purchasing content, watching content on the web easier than stealing it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And mm-hmm. that's always been sort of the fallacy, is that it's DRM is a good idea, like restricting what people do with it. It's sort of predicated on the idea of like control, that we have control, but really there's this alternative that people are going to find a way to get the content. Like if you've released it only in the US, the internet doesn't have borders. People are going to find ways of getting it. And then even worse is that you're conditioning people to behave like that rather than sort of saying
you're disincentivizing them from going through channels, which would benefit the,
yeah, exactly.
The
and then by saying, oh, you can only yeah. watch it for 24 hours, you can only watch it on 5 computers. You,
yeah.
you know, putting all these restrictions around it, you're really like driving people to find alternatives, and pretending that those alternatives don't exist is kind of foolhardy.
I had the filmmakers for The Square, a documentary that Netflix eventually mm-hmm. Bought on a few months back, last fall or summer. And my question, because, you know, this film that these two Egyptian Americans made was actually illegally, it was illegal. Like, they couldn't show it in Egypt.
Yeah.
It was banned, I should say. But, of course, all that many more people saw it because, you know, whether it was BitTorrent or what have you, but they're going to see it. In fact, you're just helping the filmmakers spread the word more for the film, even though maybe it wasn't through theaters. And
yeah, yeah. It's with internet culture, it's kind of a well-understood phenomenon called the Barbara Streisand effect, which originates with her trying to have pictures of her house removed from the internet. So the internet's response, obviously, was to just post all the photos.
She was kind of arguing with the internet.
Yeah, really. Like, she's like, don't take photos at my house.
Internet. Well, you are the first software developer I've had on the show.
All right.
But it does sort of illustrate, or it's a great, you know, it's an indication that the lines are blurring all the more. And I think one of the missions I have with this podcast is, you know, to help filmmakers kind of figure out
yeah,
how to make a living, how to traverse, you know, this landscape. And I kept hearing about you guys and what you were doing, because for indie films, so many filmmakers, you know, have given up for all intents and purposes on conventional theatricals because it's just become really difficult to do that. Or if they do, maybe it's just in a New York City because then they can have, you know, they can get the reviews and they can get if they're want to be considered for an Oscar, I suppose. That's another thing. But, you know, it's more as time goes on, it's clear that if theatricals really don't serve a lot of... So then it comes to the next part of the conversation is, well, what kind of distribution would serve me best? Do I... If I'm not going to go for theatrical, that means I guess I'm looking at VOD and I'm looking at digital platforms and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're presenting even another option.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is completely DIY, right?
Yeah, essentially, it's really... The idea is that the website for a film is this underexploited property in a lot of ways, where it's both a marketing destination, but the power of the internet is that it's easy to turn that into a store.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can sell directly from your own website. And that is the thing that is the top result in Google. It's the thing that has, you know, your face on it, your voice in it. It's a thing that fans really like to connect with. Like when you're sharing something on social media, I'm a lot more inclined to share a film's website rather than the iTunes page, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, when we were sort of working on different video projects and Star Wars Uncut and sort of seeing what was going on, it was a cathartic moment when Louis C.K. released his special, his comedy special, directly from his own website. And that was something that he had paid a design agency to build out for him custom. And
when you say a design agency, you mean a tech design?
Yeah, like a software shop to kind of build this custom website. It cost $30,000 up front and took probably a few months to build. And
but somebody had to be whispering in his ear and saying, you know, you could do this on your, I mean, do you,
yeah, I don't know the backstory. I'm kind of curious too, now that you mentioned it.
Yeah. Anyway, but continue, please.
Well, yeah. So that was a cathartic moment for us because I saw, you know, a tweet about it and clicked through and I land on a website that's got Louis's face on it and it's $5. It's DRM free. There's no reason to say no. It's not like a rental. It's just like you buy the movie, you buy the special, you get the special. Right. It's incredibly easy user experience.
So people understand DRM free. That means they can watch it. Right. Once you pay $5, you can basically do whatever you want, right?
Right. You can download a video file, which is great because a lot of, you know, the home entertainment ecosystem is so fragmented that you really can never have like an app on every platform. Like Netflix is probably the closest to having something like that. But with a DRM free file, you can just put it on your iPad, take it on the plane with you. If you're an Android person, you can put it on your Android device. And so it's sort of like a one-size-fits-all solution. I mean, honestly, that's like with piracy sites. That's why they distribute DRM-free video files. It works everywhere. It's a normal video file. Mm-hmm. And we saw that same shift happen with music, where originally the music industry was a staunch advocates for DRM and these strange media formats and sort of like, oh, you can only use it on so many devices. Like, you buy it from our store, you're locked into our store.
Yeah, I worked for that company.
There you go.
For 10 years.
Holy cow. Which company was it?
Sony Music.
Yeah. They
were the worst.
And it's funny because it's like, in the video space, I'm so surprised to be even having this DRM conversation because I thought with music we established that it was a bad idea. Yeah. And Steve Jobs, like, God bless the guy for really putting his foot down with the studios and saying, you're hurting the user experience, you're hurting the portability of this content.
Yeah.
Like, it would be really great if the things that I bought on iTunes, if I were to switch from iTunes, if I could bring those with me, but I can't. And that's really the model that we're advocating, is one where you can buy things powered by VHX and you have video files and you can do what you please with it. Mm-hmm. You know, you purchased it, you own it. I mean, most people don't know that sort of this option exists at all. They're really sort of thinking tunnel vision with theatrical and then these VOD black boxes with all the cable providers and then, oh, we'll put it in the usual suspects and iTunes and Amazon, so on and so forth. But
right. And by the way, I've heard through people who, you know, this is a couple of years old already, but that when they were making their VOD deals, that they were told, the distributors said, change the name of your film so it begins with the letter A.
Yeah.
You heard of that
yeah,
too?
Yeah, definitely hear a lot. That's actually like...
it's like people don't get beyond the A column in the...
They really... I mean, it's crazy how much it skews towards the top of the alphabet. And then even like, I've heard of movies that maybe it was like 10 something and it was T-E-N and they changed it to 10.
Yeah.
So that it sorts to the top.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's games like that where it's like, this is... you know, tricks that you're playing in order to surface yourself inside of somebody else's store.
Right.
And really the magic of the internet is the fact that nobody knows you're a dog, right? Nobody knows it's just one guy in a room making a movie, distributing it, right? You don't know if it's one person, you don't know if it's 100 people. And the face that you can put out to the world through your own website, running your own store, is incredibly powerful. And even more importantly than sort of the branding components of it and sort of the better split that we offer people is really the fact that we turn over all of the data that they're collecting from people visiting the site and where they're coming from, what countries they're coming from, and then their email addresses so that you can market to them again in the future.
So in other words, when I do this retail experience of purchasing the movie, I'm obviously providing credit card and email address.
Basically, so, yeah, and you can pay with PayPal too.
All right. So obviously, if I search for some movie or filmmaker that you know appeals to me for whatever reason, I Google their name, and then I find, hopefully at the top, eventually it'll generally be their website. Maybe go there, and right on the homepage, there's a player, right, which is your you've designed.
Yeah, it's so we have a kind of a theming system that's very similar to Tumblr, where you filmmaker comes in when they sign up for our platform, they kind of pick a theme, they can customize it, upload all of their cover art, and so they end up with like a really beautifully designed site. It works on mobile, and typically above the fold, it's the call to actions are watch the trailer and then buy the movie.
Right. You watch the trailer and at the end is like buy it now.
Exactly.
Like, rent it or buy it or
yeah, it's all purchase right now. We don't do rentals.
Okay.
And that's largely because the download component of it is so important to us in order to maximize compatibility.
So what are they downloading?
just an MP4 file.
Okay.
H.264, support all kinds of whiz bang features like 5.1 surround sound, and everything's 1080p, sort of like high bit rate, really trying to maximize the quality of it. It actually, it always kills me when I go to like iTunes or other stores and they offer the HD SD split where it's like, you know, it's a $5 for HD and it's, you know, it's only $4 for SD.
Right.
And my immediate thought when I see that is always, how do you think the filmmaker wants you to see it? Right. They want you to see it in HD. Uh-huh. Like, they, like, I don't want to go to a restaurant and the chef says, you know, this plate is $20, but I'll give you a slightly crappier version of this plate for $15.
Yeah.
And so it's really funny to me whenever I see kind of like the metaphors that we brought with us from the old video store model, like rentals. Because
that idea, again, is kind of like comes from the how good your hardware is. But now, but now you can't buy anything that doesn't play HD, right?
Yeah, and if it's on, you're on a mobile phone with a crappy connection, it's great. You should have access to the HD when you're on your computer finishing the movie. And that's kind of how we operate.
What happens then on the phone? Because I'm going to have lots of these stupid questions. But so if you're on something that doesn't really can't manage high definition, does it automatically just sort of lowers the definition?
Yeah, exactly.
On the fly?
Okay, yeah, our streaming. Yeah, it's something called it's called adaptive streaming, where you start out at like a low bit rate, and then it works its way up, hypothetically all the way up to 4K. Although our data suggests so far that nobody has an internet connection fast enough to stream 4K. And don't tell Samsung I said that, though.
Okay. Anyway, so now, no matter what device you're watching it, you can go to, that's the user experience. You can watch the full movie. And what if they can they like put this on Facebook and that kind of, or
so? Yeah, and you're linking to your normal website, and that's kind of like
the, so it's just putting in the link, you know, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Saying, watch the movie, and you can.
Yeah, and there's a trailer embed that we have that works quite well there, and then we're always sort of experimenting with exactly how things are surfaced into other social networks like
right.
that.
Yeah, yeah. So okay, so there's a code. Like a right,
like an embed code, right.
code, and it will put the trailer on Facebook for you.
Like, with the buy button too, which is great.
With the buy button,
and then but most of the time
and
that's
that
unnecessary.
That buy brings you to the homepage.
Exactly,
that's your homepage because that's
yourmovie.com/buy.
Right, gotcha. Okay, and, now I understand.
But a lot of the times, it's even more powerful to sort of have like that face for the film, and we see really amazing conversion rates to sale, which is like when somebody comes to visit the site, what percentage of them end up actually buying the movie. Mm-hmm. And in the e-commerce world, like 1% conversion is pretty good. And we see at a network level, like in 2% is a minimum and very often much higher, especially depending on sort of the kind of content that you're distributing. Like the more niche it is, the better it performs, which is really interesting, at least in terms of conversion, like maybe not in terms of overall numbers, but we have a lot of kind of, as an open platform, we do a lot of film. That's kind of like our bread and butter. We do a lot of television content. But we also do a lot of sort of like alternative content, which is like a term I really hate using.
It's miscellaneous.
Miscellaneous content, right? It's, I mean, I don't like it because it sort of frames it as being like somehow inferior to film. It's just different. Like sometimes you want to watch a movie. Sometimes you want to watch exercise videos. And they're targeted towards different audiences, or even like educational materials, like lectures, classes. This is all stuff that you could sell online. What we always say is that anything that you could have put on a DVD, you can put on VHX and sell directly to people, to sell to that like quote unquote cord cutter generation. And you know, all the people out there like me who don't have cable necessarily, like I don't have a DVD drive in my laptop anymore. Like if I can't get it digitally, I don't buy it.
Wow. And so can you talk about a couple of like success stories or maybe one of the pioneer innovators?
Yeah, we launched VHX about 2 years ago with Aziz Ansari was our first release. It was a $5 comedy special, 60-minute comedy special.
Oh, okay, sure.
And that went off. It was very successful, really sort of inspired us to gather all the gasoline we could find and pour it on the fire. We then had the pleasure of working with James Swirsky and Lisanne Peugeot from the directors of Indie Game, the movie.
Oh, okay. That's what maybe I had heard about that.
Yeah. And that was a super fun release just because it's such a great movie for one. It speaks to us as nerds who play video games
right.
too.
Yeah.
But also they took a really innovative approach towards the distribution of it, where they, you know, they made a feature-length documentary and then they took it to Sundance and they won the editing award.
But it was pre-sold before it even got to Sundance.
They were, right? Yeah, they were pre-selling copies and they had raised money on Kickstarter too. Yeah. So they sort of like came in with audience. They'd been building audience the entire time they were working on the feature. And so when they got to Sundance and they were entertaining distribution offers where it was like a North America release only, mm-hmm. they already knew that 60% of their audience was international and that these were relatively tech-savvy individuals who were not going to be limited by geographic distribution restrictions, right? So it was really important to them to have a worldwide release. They're also Canadian, so they're always on the short end of the stick with this, which I think is so funny. Like, as Americans, like, we have blinders on because we get all the movies first. Mm-hmm. But in the rest of the world, it's like our neighbors to the north are waiting a month, waiting 3 months, maybe never seeing it, which is something people don't think about. And even on our network, actually, about 55% of our sales overall are international. Mm-hmm. And so James and Lisanne, it was great because they came in without a lot of preconceptions about what they wanted to do with it. They were able to sort of approach it, thinking about it as video game publishers in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And that was that audience building where they were releasing. They released almost 90 minutes of material before the movie came out as clips throughout the process. Mm-hmm. And they had like a very good understanding of their audience even before they were going to Sundance. And so they reached out to us. We are introduced to them over Twitter. This ended up being our second movie where I believe they tweeted like, we know we want to do a DRM-free option. How can we do that? Mm-hmm. And a great writer, a guy named Andy Bayo, said, you know, you should talk to VHX. Mm-hmm. And 9 days later, we had the site up and selling. And we've been able to bring that time down substantially. Now, if your video file is ready to go, you could be up and running in an hour.
That is substantial.
And that's like mostly upload time, right? Like, I'm trying to buffer for some upload time, but and then since then, it's been a lot of interesting stuff. Like, we've gotten to work on really great movies like Computer Chess, and we work with Drafthouse Films. We have a partnership with the Sundance Institute, Sundance Creative Services Group, Artist Services. And then more recently, we helped distribute The Act of Killing. We did some cool stuff with that, actually, where they made it available to people in Indonesia for free, which is almost like what The Square did, right, where they're trying to get it into the country.
They're supporting anyway, I guess, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and so The Act of Killing, we're working on, we're helping power Kevin Spacey's new documentary Now, which I'm really excited about his production of Richard III.
Oh, right, yes.
Most recently we did kind of this movie called Camp Dakota, which was created by a couple of real high-profile YouTubers, which is not necessarily the audience that you think is making films, but they made this really entertaining comedy. They also made a documentary about it while they were making the film. They also mm-hmm. made gaggles of bonus content to be leaking out to the fans as they're going along the process. And that's ended up doing super, super well as well also. Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously conventional distributors probably have their dander up a little bit because, you know, they feel like what they can offer a filmmaker, the partnering up with them, mm-hmm. finding the audiences and developing a brand and that you guys aren't able to bring to the table.
Yeah, that's why we work with lots of distributors. And we definitely don't come at this and say Hollywood is dying and we need to save Hollywood mm-hmm. or anything like that. Like, the system works, and we're really just trying to bring it a little further into the 21st century and really connect with the younger generation, that generation that doesn't have DVD drives, and just making things more available. Like, we talk all the time about, we're just trying to close the gaps between interest and availability, where that's the international piece, right? That's the, you know, making it available from the site. Like, this was like an untapped property. And this applies as much or even more so to distributors and studios and networks as it does to individual filmmakers, because those are people who have the resources to design really beautiful and compelling websites and professionally market it out and can really take advantage too of the idea of having a mailing list,
right,
where the distributor like Drafthouse, who we work super closely with on mm-hmm. on all of their titles, like, you know, almost dozens of titles now. Whenever they release a new movie, they have a mailing list. They're persisting the audience from one release to the next. And an individual filmmaker, you might make a movie every couple of years. And so that's valuable, but maybe less valuable because you just have fewer opportunities to exploit it. Mm-hmm. But for a distributor, this is like another venue for them to sell the content that fits into a smart windowing strategy. And I think most importantly, it provides them a lot of feedback about what's working because we're exposing all the data to them.
Seems like, VHX would be a perfect option, especially for those performers that have a following, that have a really successful brand. right? Like a Louis C.K., for instance, it's an ideal thing. He doesn't have to rely on...
Right, the value that a distributor brings.
He has a show, but he's not distributing a show regardless. So he's the brand above the show. And the projects he does, whether it's live concerts, whether it's a TV series or what have you, ultimately, he can kind of go on and do whatever he wants and put it up, and people are going to buy into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, literally. It's funny because it's almost like that's the same boat that like the smallest of the filmmakers are into, which is sort of like they can't get distribution. You know, like I make my like backyard wrestling
videos. Right, so they can, I guess, create now, like a calling card of sorts too, if they're interested in the distribution.
Yeah,
and they can create their own content, distribute it using VHX, and then maybe have something to show.
Exactly.
With success.
And we end up talking about this all the time because marketing is 100% the biggest problem that people face. It's just discovery. How do I get the word out there about my film? And that is the value that.
Yeah,
and talking about it. And that is the value that distributors bring to the table, is that they distribute a lot of movies. They know it's got to start with an A. And more than that, they can help you with things like the key art. They can help you kind of getting the word out. And they're putting money behind it. And there's sort of that's the traditional relationship of like, we're going to buy the rights from you, and then we're going to exploit those rights and help you market this and get butts in seats and get people seeing this movie.
Right.
But what we think about a lot is what is like the core value proposition of what they're doing? Getting video files in front of people will become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, you know, and the cost of that and the difficulty of that will fall to zero, essentially, where right now, like delivering to iTunes is very difficult, but it's not hard at all to extrapolate a world where iTunes has a direct upload and it's just really easy to get it out there. Mm-hmm. And so you have to think about like sort of how that changes the value proposition of a distributor. And it really is this marketing expertise. It is this audience that they're bringing to the table. And that might change the dynamics of how you work with a distributor. You know, like maybe it isn't something where they're paying money for it up front. Maybe they're actually being cut in as like a partner mm-hmm. in the distribution. Or maybe the filmmaker is, instead of having to like carve out the rights to distribute from their own website, we really think that should be part of a holistic package where you have a team working together. You have a partner that you're working with, and there is there's a part part of the deal is that it's like, hey, we're going to sell from the site. Mm-hmm. We're going to kind of do that whether or not we sign with you. But because more people are visiting the site because of your marketing efforts, we're going to have like a royalty payment back and forth. And it's more like a rev share model rather than I'm going to take your art and distribute your art for you. Mm-hmm. Because the filmmakers are the ones who know the most about their audience. You know, they're the ones who ostensibly care the most about how it's presented to the world, really care the most about it being seen by as many people as possible. They should really be a fundamental part of that process. And the tools that we're providing kind of, it's the idea is, you know, get as close to the bone as possible with it, where it is the filmmaker, right? It is Louis, it is Aziz, it is James and Lisanne, it is the people who made it. Like when they're writing, like all of our tools have like custom messages associated with it. And we always encourage people that when mm-hmm. you buy it, there should be like a custom note from the filmmaker thanking the author. And there's some really amazing examples that we always post on our blog, like Dave Grohl with Sound City. He's got this incredibly long, thoughtful, heartwarming message that you get in your inbox after you buy the movie. And so that's kind of, I think, the conversation that we're having now. And we are compatible with all kinds of distribution deals. We work directly with the distributors. We even have an interesting new feature we're working on where we can sort of help pay multiple parties based on the geography. So if you're a film that's sold in 15 regions, you could still have one website where you're selling the film on the website, and then you're just paying out to different providers depending on where those sales were. So we're trying to, that is always the idea with VHX, is really not like creating something totally new. It's
a new
not
set of problems.
Right. Yeah. That's just a whole new set of problems. Right. It's, we want to just help transition from sort of like a world where geographic borders really mattered to a world where it's all internet all the time, and transition from a world where it's these long windows of theatrical and then home video into something where it's a little more chaotic, you know, a little more flexible, like, because it really totally does depend on your release. And that is the value that a distributor brings to the table, is they have the experience to know, oh, you know, you've made a documentary about race cars. Like, this audience in our experience behaves sort of like this.
Right.
And so they bring a lot of value to the table, and we're always really interested to see, like we work really closely with Mark Schiller from Bond 360.
Yeah, Mark. He's been on the show.
He's been on the show. And he, you know, he's launching a new model for what a distributor could look like. And I even think that filmmakers are in a position to sort of behave like a small version of what a distributor does, like lending that marketing support. And even your relationship with Rooftop Films, right, is they are your distributor, mm-hmm. you know, and it's ostensibly, it is that like marketing help, that like helping drive eyeballs. That really is the big problem. And so we're always exploring more ways that we could help solve that using software and using like a platform as a service and helping drive eyeballs and increase exposure without necessarily saying, oh, we're going to put you on the front page and you should start with an A. You
right. Know? Yeah. No, I agree with that. So how do filmmakers find you?
Find VHX?
Yeah.
Whew, God, that is a $1 million question, right? listen to podcasts where we're interviewed. But, you know, it's really been a lot of hustling on our part. We try to put out a lot on our blog and on our mailing list to spread right. the word about what we're doing. And then we speak at a lot of festivals. And then we're constantly doing outbound. When we hear about a cool movie, when somebody mentions it to us, we always reach out to them and say...
Oh, you do?
Yeah, we just say, hey...
We're here. Just, if you need
this
us.
Exists. Right. This is a thing. It's a new thing.
Yeah.
But it's very exciting.
Now you have, like, here are some success stories.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a great body of case studies.
Right.
There is not a deal blend that we have not seen now. And so no matter what you're doing, VHX can fit into that strategy, either in a small way or in a very big way.
So they can go to the website, and that's the start
in terms of
creating an account, I suppose, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, we've been in kind of a private beta period for the last year
So you have to create a relationship first.
No. So as of last month, we're open to the public,
okay,
and anybody can sign up and start selling their projects right away. And the hour to release is...
Make sure you have an hour to do...
Just block out an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
Finish your movie, and then block out an hour.
Right afterwards.
You know, even if your movie's not done, one of the things that we're trying to spread the message around is that, you know, the marketing begins when you name the movie. Maybe even before you finish the script or anything, right?
You might change your name, though.
You might change the name, but just, you know... Yeah. Buy both domain names.
Right.
And the idea is actually like, so even if you're not ready to sell the content yet, mm-hmm. it's important to have a website. It's important to be collecting email addresses. It's important to be thinking about
yes.
how you're going to message it to the world, who your audience is,
right.
long before you've actually even finished it.
Well, a lot of people are doing that with their crowdsourcing.
Totally.
I mean, with their Kickstarter campaigns is a great opportunity to kind of figure that out. It's a mm-hmm. way to kind of launch that brand and to start getting the community, your audience together.
Yeah, one service that we offer actually totally for free is fulfilling rewards for backers. Since we found, you know, films that have done Kickstarter projects, they've uh-huh. gotten this audience building
sure.
going. And they also have... There is not really a very reliable way to distribute the movie to reward
the gift
to all the backers. Yeah,
I thought that's what you meant. So yeah. if in other words, if you contribute $100 to my Kickstarter, mm-hmm. you get a free copy of the movie thanks to VHX.
Yeah, and it's all powered by us. And they'll essentially just get an email right. that says, click here to redeem it, and then they can start watching it or download it.
Right, and they have the link that gets them around the pay process.
Exactly, yeah. And we have, you know, that's like a feature that we have platform-wide
sure.
where it's like coupons, basically.
You use it for certain countries.
Yeah. Yeah, Indonesia. Just targeted just for Indonesia.
For active killing.
Yeah, and even things that we're experimenting with. Like, we're always thinking about interesting mm-hmm. new ways of reaching more people in the world because we have such an international audience. One thing that I'm interested in is sort of, you know about the Big Mac Index?
No.
Which is the price of a Big Mac in different countries. And so it relates to sort of the relative purchasing power of people in that country.
Sure.
And we've done a lot of research around, like, what the average DVD price is in different countries.
Uh-huh.
And it's all over the place, for
of
one.
Of course.
But... more importantly, like, we're very interested in the idea of, can our platform as a whole reduce the price of something because it's in sort of like a more price sensitive country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of stuff that we're always thinking about because, like, we have conversations with filmmakers who have amazing ideas, kind of interesting approaches. They want to distribute in Indonesia for free. And we're always thinking about, we work really closely with people and we have really pride ourselves on our customer support, but we always want to roll that into like a feature, mm-hmm. you know, something that we could deploy to everybody.
Thank you. Jamie Wilkinson. The company's called VHX, and you can check out their website to learn more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, VHX.tv.
There you go, VHX.tv. You can Google that, too, and check out. They have a new website. So thank you very much for coming on and talking about your product.
That was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. I'm actually going to be back early next week with a very nice full length hour plus conversation with filmmaker, photographer, artist Jem Cohen. That's coming up early next week. It's a Fandor sponsored episode. He has two films on Fandor. One is his most recent narrative feature called Museum Hours, which did quite well. And the other one is a concert film that he made some time ago, which I believe took about 10 years of his life to make, but it's called Instrument, and it's about the band Fugazi that he had a personal connection with. Those two films are available on Fandor. You could check them out prior to my conversation with Jem, which should be probably by Tuesday, the latest that episode will be up. I'm kind of a little bit diverging from the normal schedule, which is every Wednesday, because I have a few episodes here and there, extra episodes and special episodes. So just keep checking in. You know, if you subscribe, you don't have to worry about it, because it'll just be on your iPhone or your whatever your smartphone device or iPad or tablet device is. So that's my kind of way of elbowing you in the ribs a little bit and reminding you, if you're not currently subscribed, go ahead and do so. You can go to the your podcast app or iTunes or what have you and download the show. It's very easy to find. It's the only podcast that's called Film Wax Radio or has the word Film Wax in it. And if you are on iTunes, there is the opportunity to rate it. They give you up to 5 stars. You can leave comments, and those things, especially the rating, is extremely helpful. I pretty much leave this message every week for you to hear. I'm sorry for that, but you know, I still could use, I know there are hundreds of people that listen to the show, into the thousands of people over time that have listened to the show, and it only takes a couple of moments of your time just to go into iTunes and find it and then just give it a nice star rating. And the more people that do that, the more likely that other people will discover Film Wax Radio on iTunes, because the more high ratings you get, the further up the pyramid the podcast goes. So, and then the other thing is also other ways of staying in touch. Of course, the Film Wax Radio on Facebook. There is a Film Wax page as well, but you want to go to the facebook.com/Film Wax Radio and like it, because that way you can get updates about new episodes and all sorts of other ancillary content. I'm going to get back onto the newsletter. I've just fallen behind, of course. There's only so many hours in the day, and it takes a lot of time to put those together. But I will get the newsletter out more regularly. If you're interested in signing up to that, it should make it easier, you know. But I'm going to have an all-new website up probably by the summer, which will streamline everything for you anyway. So that's all coming up very soon. And what else? Rooftop Films. Don't let me forget that. May 16th is only a couple of weekends away. Are having their first weekend, initial launching weekend for the summer 2014. They're going to be at Industry City on both the 16th and 17th. The 16th is their first shorts block. This is what we mean by short film. And that'll be Friday the 16th, I believe. And then on the Saturday the 17th, they're going to play Gillian Robespierre's film, Obvious Child, with Jenny Slate and Gabby Hoffman. You may remember Gillian was on the recent live podcast. And speaking of that, we'll be posting the video for that shortly. Somebody is editing as I speak, and we should have it up in the next few days. So you can look at that. There will be another live podcast coming up. It's already scheduled. It's not official in the sense that we've published this yet, but I will say, if you're listening, it's highly likely that it will take place on June 16th, the evening of June 16th at the Nighthawk Cinema in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And so, but I'll give more details as those things fall together. You may want to come out and check us out. It's a lot of fun. We had a great time the first go around. And what else is happening here that I don't want to forget about? Well, I mentioned Jem Cohen is coming up this week. We have also, again, I mentioned a few weeks now, we have coming up in the next week or two also a conversation with D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus. You know, there are these legendary documentary filmmakers who have made amazing documentaries over the years, and finally are having them on the show. That will be happening in, I think, just 2 weeks from now. I'll have that show up and out for you. And then again, I mentioned the show I did with Megan Griffiths will be up soon. I have another show with Joe Swanberg coming up, which will also be Fandor sponsored. Joe has about 4 films up on Fandor, and we spoke recently again. It's his 3rd time on the show. Thank you to Joe Swanberg for that. And also a show with a filmmaker named Livia DePaulis. She and her producer, the lovely Danelle Eliav, are coming on the show to talk about their new film called Emoticon, much, much more. So I'm going to take leave of you now, but please do shoot me a note at adam@filmwax.com, and let's talk. Let's chat. Let me know what you think and any thoughts you have. I did hear from a few people recently, and I will watch your links and get back to you. That is my solemn vow to you. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time, thanks so much. Take care.